You're listening to Talk the Walk, the podcast putting legs on social work in Indigenous communities through story. From Darwin, Australia, this is your host, Lucy Van Sambeek. Hello and welcome back to Talk the Walk. Today I am talking with Suda Catino. While her university training is occupational therapy, Suda has found herself working extensively in the field of mental health, suicide prevention and training. Her career spans over 30 years, much of it working alongside and with Indigenous Australians. I came across one of Suda's more recent projects when I was invited to respond to some stories collected as part of the Telling Stories project in Kalumburu. This work is very much influenced by the field of narrative therapy and her like-minded colleague, Claire Wood. Suda says she has always been interested in stories, those we tell about ourselves and those others tell about us, and the power in these stories to influence both the storyteller and the listener. I'm really looking forward to this conversation as we explore more about the Telling Stories project, as well as hear more stories. Suda's stories about her experience in direct clinical service delivery, service development and training provision over the last 20 years here in Northern Australia. Welcome to the podcast, Suda, and thanks for joining me.
Thank you, Lucy.
Suda, you've had such an interesting career, and I'm absolutely fascinated with how an occupational therapist comes to be doing what is a community development project, gathering stories about Aboriginal people's strengths, skills and knowledge. There's obviously a lot of steps to get to this point, working on a project like Telling Stories, but I'm wondering if you might begin by giving us some background about how you came to be working in Northern Australia, particularly with Aboriginal communities.
Right, well, it's sort of one of those classic unplanned journeys in a way, and I'm an occupational therapist, as you said, and an occupational therapist is very much around supporting someone in the life that they want to lead. And to be able to do that really is being able to hear about that story, hearing the story of what is it that's important to someone, what is it that they want to focus their attention on, what do they value the most. And so in that way I see myself that it is in a way a natural progression to move into a narrative concept of working, of listening to people's stories and really listening properly to what it is that someone's particularly wanting. And I had lived, you know, I grew up and studied in WA and went to, you know, went overseas and was always drawn to hearing stories from people. And so therefore mental health was really the area for me because that was the place that really, as a clinician, and particularly as a clinician, as an OT, where often you get a chance to really sit and have conversation with someone, that I was really fascinated with people's stories and about what it is that they valued, what they held really strongly in their lives and what they wanted to put first in their recovery. And I think that was really telling. So I travelled the world and did some work and then ended up living on a farm in the southwest, and then it was got three winters in and I thought, I might just go up north for a winter. And I migrated to Broome just for the sun.
Right.
And then I found myself there 18 years later, having not only found the sun, but also finding myself in a world which, given that I had spent most of my life living in Australia, I knew very little about, and that was Indigenous Australia. And so I was really fortunate to work with and alongside the mob in the Kimberley and learnt a lot, and actually learnt a lot about myself as a person, my own culture. My family has an Indian background, and you know, growing up as I did in the 70s in Australia, trying to kind of distance myself from my culture very strongly. You know, we're the only Indian kids in our school. You know, we were trying very much to keep a low profile in our culturally low profile, and you know, be really embarrassed about things like sandwiches with curry mints and the smells that would come from my mum's kitchen and all of those sort of things. And then to move to the Kimberley and start to really watch and learn from a culture that was really strong and really honouring And I think my mother was very pleased when I actually wanted to know more about my own cultural story, and I would go out to communities. And, you know, in the Kimberley, there are lots of people who have Indian heritage as well. And so people would often ask me, who was I and who was my mob and where was I from? And, you know, it became really kind of exciting to be able to say, well, actually, first of all, I have to say it probably became very embarrassing because I realised I knew so little about my own history and my own heritage. And so, you know, so it became a learning journey for me as well. Yeah, so I found myself working in the Kimberley, really, and working and learning, I suppose, in the Kimberley and getting to know a little bit more about who I was and how I wanted to practice. And there was a real shift in my practice. I think I had been, could have been around, I must have been out for about 20 years by the time I got myself to the Kimberley. And in many ways, it shifted my practice quite strongly. Similarly, I'm sure with social work, when you train, there's a very big, strong sense of separation from you and your client. And not the sharing of story. That sharing a story is actually not sharing, it's just listening from one side, and it's not a collaborative space. Mm. And that's just not possible in Indigenous communities. And I used to often go down to do locum work in the southwest in the wet season when it's really hot. And I would find myself back down in Perth for Christmas and would pick up work. And it was interesting for me about how my practice changed over that time.
Yeah.
So I would notice myself being much more giving about who I was, my history, my story as part of the setting space. And I would notice clinicians down there being somewhat surprised at my approach and my sharing. You know, I was an old girl by then. I was a senior clinician. So in a sense, people took that in their stride a little bit. But I sort of wondered what it might have been like if I had been relatively new to the space. But what a dramatic change and shift that made in relationship building and moving away from the kind of expert model that we can get caught up with in how we present ourselves in someone else's life. And again, that's why I really love narrative work, that idea that actually there is much wisdom in the way that people have managed to go through difficult times in their life. And really, I feel like our role as clinicians is more to support someone find that, what it was that was their key, that sort of gets them there in front of you. When, you know, sometimes I would listen to stories in the Kimberley. And particularly in the Kimberley, I think, because they were so multifaceted and there was so much, to be honest, there was so much hardship in those stories that I would sometimes listen to them and wonder how could this person have managed to still be here with me, having this conversation where I would question my own resilience and how resilient would I have been in that situation. I was always intrigued and curious to know what it was and how did that person managed to keep standing. So that inquiry, I think, opens up really amazing stories.
So what were those early days like for you in Broome when you rocked up there? And how did you come to learn that, gee, I'm going to have to do things a little bit differently here than the way I've been trained and the way I've been practicing to this point?
I imagine that I probably failed a lot initially and I may have got away with the kindness of locals, really. And, you know, I think the mob that I was working with were incredibly generous around being supportive of someone who hopefully had good intent and may have bumbled my way through. And I was very fortunate to, I didn't work clinically when I first went up to Broome. I actually worked in a cafe and decided that I was, because I hadn't intended to live in Broome. I'd intended to go and have a really great winter and go to the dry season, and I worked in a cafe and I met lots of people, and I think I just started to get a sense of the pulse of the community a little bit more, and without a clinical hat. And I think that made a really big difference. You know, I started to meet with and play with and hang out with people in a way that as clinicians we don't. You know, I've met people as you meet someone, and as we should, in a clinical space, but we don't. So there wasn't an expert, and I went off to Yaru language, and I went on an amazing walking trail, the Lurajari Trail, which is a 10-day walk, and it's walking a particular song line, the Lurajari song line. And I just remember learning, you know, rocking up to the language classes first and thinking, it says it starts at 6 and, you know, no one's here, and I couldn't understand it. And then I went to this trail and I you know, rang up a really good friend of mine down south and said, come on down, you know, come to this trail, it sounds great. And we'd done lots of hikes before and, you know, we travelled quite a lot together around the world, and it just seemed really disorganised. And we were going, this is just a bit odd because we just weren't used to it. And I think that the Rowe family really taught me a lot in those 10 days, and that was probably the biggest cultural immersion, if you want to call it that, that I'd ever had. It was really beautiful to watch. Well, it would have been really interesting, I think, to have filmed both Veronica and I trying to make sense of how this was such a different way of doing things, and then being able to drop what we thought it should be like, and then realising what a great joy it was to do it, or to learn how to do it and see it in a different way.
Yeah.
I don't know if that quite answered your question about how, but I think it's about actually, yeah, the generosity of people of allowing me to stuff up, but hopefully stuff up with good intent. And, of course, not only my Indigenous colleagues, but also there were non-Indigenous colleagues and friends who had lived in that area for a very long time and who equally were guides in a way of letting me know about things. I think the beauty of spending a lot of time, you know, having 18 years in that community meant that I saw young people grow up. I got to know families and I got another sense of how you might work in that space.
And so most of your work's been in the mental health sector and the social and emotional well-being area. That can be challenging at times, can't it? That people are sometimes in crisis mode or at the depths of despair sometimes. And I'm wondering what really keeps you going, because you've been doing it for a long time. And what would you say is your drive or your passion behind what you're doing?
I think the passion for me, or the drive, has been to be able to move from that idea of mental health and psychiatry, which, you know, I have great respect for in many ways, but also to be able to look much more broadly at that concept of social emotional well-being. And I've really thought, I really enjoyed that movement. And I think that, you know, we often talk around Indigenous people having such a strong concept of social emotional well-being. And I often talk to groups or clients or whoever about, you know, how much wisdom there is in that way of looking at well-being, and how much we can all take from it, whether we're Indigenous or not. So I think that move from a more medical model to being able to sit in both worlds a little bit, as in both frameworks, I should say, not both worlds, both frameworks, has been really exciting to be able to do that. And I think one of the passions about being working this way is, as an occupational therapist, one of the curses for OTs is that people often don't quite know exactly what we do. And actually, I think that that's one of the joys as well, because it often means we can do really incredibly exciting things because people aren't quite sure what box to put us in. So that allows us to bring a really lovely opening of that concept about how I may choose to work with individuals or with groups of people. But I have to say that when I worked in the Kimberley, I didn't actually work as an occupational therapist. It was a multidisciplinary team that was doing community work, and it was really around assessment and case management and triage, and there were multiple clinicians with different backgrounds who were doing it. But having said that, we all bring our own framework into the work of how we have those conversations and how we might set up those spaces to listen to stories differently depending on where we come from, so or what framework we come from.
So you mentioned the idea that Indigenous concept of well-being is very different to perhaps what we might bring from our cultural background. Are you able to articulate what you see as the Indigenous concept of well-being, and what does that look like?
I suppose I can only articulate it to my understanding of it, not being Indigenous. I suppose what I find interesting is that having been working in the area of mental health for such a long time, there has been this real interesting shift where mental health with psychiatry, which is supposedly based very much on science, has really started to look at some of the things that they weren't so embracing initially, with things like mindfulness, meditation, very much around the Eastern traditions, health and well-being, which I think when I look at the concept of Indigenous social emotional well-being, to me sits quite, it aligns very well in many ways to much more of an Eastern way of looking at well-being in that really broader concept. I don't know of many other, I think that sort of long connection to country that is not only in present but also in past, and I think that seems a concept that I don't see in many other places. But yeah, I don't know if I'm very good at articulating it. I think that it's a really interesting space, but it's around that balance of actually knowing around the culture and the values and beliefs that really come in that area, that when we're often talking about mental health and the previous sort of biopsychosocial model, which, you know, I'm sure, you know, we all at the time that was the expounded framework, we're all very, you know, excited about. This seems like such a multifaceted way to work. And now when I look at it, I see going, oh, yes, but it so misses out spiritual and cultural. And I think, you know, that's the component that in fact, we all have. You know, we all have our own culture. We all have our own spiritual beliefs. And honouring that space and understanding where people's values and beliefs come in, then I think is something that non-Indigenous peoples can really take up and have a much richer sense of how do we really understand what someone needs to do to keep in balance and what's out of balance for someone.
Yeah, it's interesting that you say that the areas of psychiatry are really starting to take notice of things like mindfulness and those kinds of practices, because science is really just catching up to show us that those things are beneficial, whereas Indigenous people have been using those kinds of practices for a very long time. It's only now that we've got the evidence, isn't it, that they are working.
Yeah,
they are beneficial for people. So yeah, it's really lovely culture to bring.
That's the difference too, isn't it, between the science and the art. You know, I often think about my practice has, there is an art to working in the area of mental health that isn't just about science. And the science is where we look at the evidence and we look at, you know, wanting to assess things and having very clear ways of doing it. But there's also some alchemy that happens that is
very intuitive, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, so I think it's a beautiful marriage in those two spaces. We have trouble sometimes that in the Western space of understanding how do we use that in our professional lives and maintain professionalism. And what does that mean? What does it mean when we're talking about being professional, and what does it mean when we're actually listening to stories in a way that's respectful? And that's based in true exploration or true knowing and not something kind of left field.
Yeah, so that's a really good lead-in, actually, to talk about the Telling Stories project. And I was wondering if you could give us some insight. What is this project about?
Well, I think the kind of the idea of how this project really started to form in my head was my lovely collaborator, Claire Wood, who is a narrative practitioner, and I were working together down south in one of my sabbaticals from the wet, and we were sitting on a beach and we were, I suppose, marvelling in a way at the stories and the clients that we saw and about their level of resilience. And I had been working as a triage clinician in the north, and there was sort of four clinicians, and so a lot of our work was about listening to stories with a subtext of us listening for ill health or psychosis concerns or DSM-5 criteria. You know, so we were listening and we're really inquiring to find where is this ill health or is there ill health.
So it's very much around the problem story that you're listening for. Yes.
So Claire and I were sitting on this beach going, wouldn't that be lovely if we had the opportunity to actually listen for the alternate story? Because there's always another story going on that we both thought, and you know, we both thought would be a much healthier story for someone to hear and to have reflected back to them. And, you know, I think both of us in our practice would always look at reflecting as much as we could an alternate story, listening to the assessment of such inverted commas. But I think we wanted to just be able to do that, you know, just to be able to actually have these really intentional conversations with people where that was the story we were uncovering. And that happened to be a WA Mental Health Commission suicide prevention grant at the time. And we sort of got excited thinking, why don't we just apply for it and just see? Let's just see how creative and brave that the WA Mental Health Commission can be about taking a new way of looking at working. And we had a lot of evidence. You know, there's been a lot of work written around the importance of not only in narrative practice literature, but also, you know, in the literature around cultural continuity and the importance of those sorts of things that's written in the Canadian stories. So we thought we had nothing to lose, so we put it in and the commission picked it up, and we had an opportunity to frame up a project that we were really excited about. And Claire had connections, strong connections actually, with Kalumburu Women's Group, Trimala Women's Group. It's based in Kalumburu, which is a remote community in the northwest of WA. And we were really, struck around how this particular community, it had a pretty rough telling of their story in the media. And for a small community, had very much been given a dominant story. And we were, quite concerned, I suppose, that there were many other stories within that community, but that community was also internalising those stories. I think once you get told a particular story about yourself or your community, that's the story that sticks.
Mm.
And so we were keen, as were the Trimala Strong Women's Group, to unearth some alternative stories. And so we decided that we would do that. And we had such a great, it was actually a real pleasure to even sit and have these multiple conversations, even with Claire, my colleague. So I went back to Broome and she was in Margaret River. So it was this kind of hilarious distance between us. And our project was in Kalumburu, which is, another 10 hours away from where I was living. So we would have these great phone dates and have these great conversations around what was the intent of what we were doing, how did we want to structure it. I think about how long we spent on even really thinking through the consent and what that meant and how we would write it and how would we describe the project to people, the words that we would use. And I just realised that often clinically we just don't get enough time to even structure things in the way that we would really love to. And we're often having to do things on such a quick space that when we can actually take time to really be conscious about how we might approach something, it's such a gift if we can do it. And it makes such a difference in the way that we approach what we're going to do if we've had a chance to think through it. So we finally got through all this sort of paperworky clarity or not. And then we had the next challenge, which was the technical challenge, because one of the things that we did in the Telling Story project was to spend time in community and have intentional conversations with people who were interested to have those conversations. And then we did the concept of outside witnessing to recording those conversations in different ways. And for some people who were interested, we did that through making small films where we recorded the interviews, both audio and visual recordings. And then Claire and I had the intention that we would then rescue those words and then be able to return the story with the drawing out of this alternate story for the storytellers. Some of the storytellers chose not to do that, and we would write therapeutic letters back. So we had lots of therapeutic letters that were also returned to community members in project number one. But also there was a learning curve for Claire and I in using all this recording equipment. So neither of us came from a media background. So it was hilarious. And when we finally returned some of the stories, some of the women just laughed and said, oh, I didn't think it was going to turn out so well. I'm thinking, yes, that might have been because we were a little bit bumbly with all the equipment. But it was really delightful. And we had driven to Kalumburu and we drove back. We stopped at Mitchell Plateau and set up camp and had this beautiful few days of listening to the recordings and pulling out the stories that we wanted to, or the threads of the stories that we wanted to return. And then had them, and then we got them sort of shaped up and returned the stories to community, which was a really lovely component of the sharing the story and asking the storytellers to then reflect about what it was like to see their story be returned in this way. And I remember Ashlyn, one of the storytellers, who was our youngest storyteller at age 17, and also the first storyteller that we did and or had the conversation with. And when she listened to her story, her comment was something like, I didn't know I could be so inspirational, which was so beautiful. And it was really beautiful to have some of the strong women view that video as well, because they had made great concerns around their community about the young people, as they described, what the young people were doing and how the young people were not living up to what they would want. And so it was really beautiful for them to see this story and then respond back to Ashlyn, but also in a way challenge their own dominant story about what they thought was happening within their community. It was a very moving experience to return the stories and also to have the stories viewed by other people who then were looking at Colombo in a very different way. And we started what we call the Archive of Strength, Hope and Resilience. And we have now been very fortunate to have a couple of projects now based in Colombo, and that archive has been growing. Digital stories, but also of many, many intentional conversations looking at those threads of strength, hope and resilience that is sometimes reminding community and reminding individuals where those threads are that they've kind of let drop or left hidden and just, in a sense, I suppose, exposing them again, letting people rediscover how they might pick up that thread and use it in a way for the next part of their journey or to return to that journey.
I want to ask you around going back to the process of interviewing these people in the community. Can you explain the process for people who are not familiar with narrative ways of working? How are you having those conversations? What sort of questions are you asking, or how are you drawing out those stories? What's the process?
Well, the process, I suppose, is interesting in a way that there is no set agenda, which I think is and a really novel approach for a clinician to go through without a set agenda of knowing what we want. So often it is around having the conversation about what is it that that person would like to share with us, what is the story that they'd like to tell us. And what I found really interesting initially is that people will often start thinking that we want to hear a story as an anthropologist may hear a story. You know, in remote communities, storytelling and sharing has opted for non-Indigenous, so sort of non-Indigenous persons turning up saying, love to hear your story. The mob would often start telling us about their story from a very different perspective, from an anthropological perspective. And what we were really interested in is to know their story, not necessarily their ancestor's story. And what was the cultural continuity? Where did they learn some of the things that they, the hopes they had, the values, the things that were important to them? That may then create this link to those who've gone before them and where they learnt that story. And it was really interesting to also watch what people thought we wanted to hear. So we had a beautiful interview with a woman who was a, she was a cultural teacher within the school. And when we were asking her about her role and what it was that she did, because that was obviously something that was really important to her, she started talking about how important it was for the kids to learn to read and write. And I felt a bit like she was actually giving us an education department tick-off conversation that that was part of her role. And then when we started talking to her about, or asking more of the questions, and what other things are really important for the young people to learn, you won't see it in the videos, but she then starts talking around connection to country, connection to culture. And what you will see in the video is a very animated, passionate woman talking about something that really is very important. But we didn't get to that straight away, because initially she wanted to tell us the story that she thought we wanted to hear.
So tell me about the skills then, because that's a particular skill, isn't it? To be able to get a person to the place of really sharing what's important to them.
Yeah.
Can you articulate, I guess, what the skills are, or what particular techniques, or what is it that helped you to get that person to that place where they could share that?
Well, I need to really acknowledge that that was Claire Wood who was doing that particular interview. And I think the skills in those interviews and when we're having that conversation is to be ongoingly curious about what you're curious around. And, you know, we can sit in front of people, we know whether they're talking their passion or not. And I suppose there's the skill of being open and curious, truthfully curious about really wanting to know. And at the same time, bouncing off that person and knowing if they're talking about something that really excites them. One of the things that the team really laugh about is that I'm a talker, as you may have noticed. And so my interviews go on for a really long time, and our poor editor, who happened to come with us the last project, I could see poor Alex feeling slightly anxious about how long these interviews were going for, because I am curious around the story, and there's always that mix between process and product around where you're going with that. So yes, I think just being curious, asking those questions, all the questions that we learn about how to ask when we're working in the area of counselling or whatever it might be. But I think it's about really wanting to know what is the actual story. Yeah, what is it that makes someone shine in that way?
You talked earlier about the intent of the project, and I just wanted to explore a bit more. What was it that you set out to do, or what did you hope to achieve through this project?
I think what we're hoping to do is to have to provide a platform for people whose voices are often not heard in the story that they're wanting to tell. Mm-hmm. And so providing that space for community and individuals to tell their story in a way. I think Barbara Wingard always talks around, you know, telling stories in ways that make us stronger. And I really love that concept. Mm. And I think it's really interesting, not only in this Telling Story project, but also in my own life, I think, around that thing of what is it that I continue to tell myself, and, you know, how, you know, classic CBT sort of framework, you know, how helpful or unhelpful is it? And I think that that's part of what this project was about, was to support individuals and community really look at an alternative story for themselves that they can sort of allow to shine and to be witnessed by themselves, and for it to be witnessed to others.
Mm.
The outside witnessing part was a really important component, and, you know, often as a clinician, we can be the outside witnesser, and we did that in the first project where we wrote outside witness letters and responses back to the individuals who shared their stories who didn't want to be recorded on video. And obviously we can only record so many because of the cost of and the time of being able to do that. Whereas for those who were recorded on video or audio, you know, we put those on platforms that were allowed other people to witness those stories. And so it was really lovely to have that opportunity for community to share their story. Mm. You know, we had a lovely, in our second Telling Story project, we recorded some more stories, and then I played those stories shared those stories with some people from Kununurra. And it was really beautiful to hear some of the responses that we were able to take back. So another community responding, saying, "You're so inspiring as a group. We're really proud of you." You know, and all of those things about, you know, we're going to take this on board. You know, I can't remember exactly the quote, so I'm not quoting at all. But it was really lovely for an opportunity for that sharing to happen.
So speak a bit more about what have been the benefits for other communities as a whole hearing Kalumburu's community story. What has that meant to the other communities hearing that?
Well, I have to be honest, it's not that we've taken it to that many communities. Mm-hmm. You know, I had an opportunity because I was in Kununurra working with Wurundjeri Aboriginal Corporation. And so I had an opportunity to share the stories with their social emotional wellbeing team and a few of their staff within that service. Most of the viewing outside of that has been through different platforms. One of the most successful platforms that we've been very fortunate to share the videos through has been ABC Kimberley. So four of the stories, have been played on ABC Kimberley and then have been posted up on their Facebook page. And some of those responses have been really incredible. And that's from people all around Australia, obviously through the Kimberley, people who have worked in the Kimberley, who are no longer there, who are then responding about what it is, what it means to listen to those stories. You know, as you would be aware, that with outside witnessing, often there's very specific questions that people are set up with to reflect upon. And although on the Vimeo sites we ask those questions, on Facebook, on ABC Kimberley, they didn't. So it was a very sort of response, you know, just to the video. And even that, I think, was incredibly rich for the storytellers to have this really lovely sense of other people actually responding and hearing their story. And, you know, Claire and I would love to do another project in another community to have that opportunity to share those stories across communities. And we're looking at the potential of, we're always looking at potentials and how we might be able to do that. And so we'll just continue to explore those spaces around whether we can actually find either other communities to do projects with or have an opportunity for communities to view these stories and about what it means. Mm. And it was lovely when we went back for our last trip. We had a video story sharing evening at, or day, sorry, at the Tjamala Women's Group Centre. And it was so beautiful to sit in a room of women who knew each other from community, who spent every day almost in each other's lives,
mm-hmm.
but never had really heard their friend being spoken or speaking in this way, or hearing that story or the reframing of that story mm-hmm. in that space. And it was really lovely to watch. Asking this particular woman who said to me she didn't want her story shared, and I was saying, look, let's just you and I watch it, and you invite one person to come and watch it with us, who someone she really trusted. And so the three of us sat down, and her friend's response to the story created a space where then she was happy for that story to be shown in the larger group. And it was so beautiful to see multiple of age groups in that space. And, yeah, and having a sharing around that.
It makes me wonder about the story you've just shared about that woman sharing her story in front of a friend and then that going really well and her saying, okay, let's share it with a wider group. Is that having some impact on maybe the shame that she had originally? Is there something going on there where she's been able to overcome that shame about sharing it to a wider group originally? What happened there?
Yeah, I don't know. I think, you know, we often talk around the work that set her up in setting up the outside witnessing. So it's really not just about going, okay, now watch this video and then what's your response? You know, we do some conversation before about what we're asking people to listen out for. And I think that sort of tunes people into what they're actually listening for in hearing the story. I think, you know, obviously these stories are edited because we're rescuing words, and the story that we're rescuing is the story of the strength and the hope and the resilience. And so when someone's listening to that, we're hoping that that's what they're hearing, is that they're hearing the words of strength, hope and resilience. And that is a really important thing for people, and it's unlikely someone's going to listen to that and not find it exciting. So in that way, yes.
Yeah, and probably help. To have that story reflected back to you, it's like, oh, wow, someone's really acknowledging this skill, strength, value, whatever it is that I have. Yeah, and that's, like you say, a different story that they're hearing to the problem one that's so common and known. That's really beautiful. So if people were wanting to participate in some way in this project, whether it's watching a video that's already up and out there and sending a response, is that possible for people listening?
Yes, it is, and it's really welcomed. It's welcomed by not only the Tjamala Strong Women's Group and the storytellers, who have all been very excited about sharing their story, but obviously also by Claire and I and the Telling Story Project. So all the stories are on the platform on Vimeo, and I understand they'll be on Historically Speaking as well.
Yeah, we can put it on the show notes at the end. Yeah, for people to follow up afterwards.
Yep.
A link that'll take them straight to the stories.
Yeah. That would be great.
Then what should they do?
So then they can either respond. There is a comment section on the Vimeos, and so they can put their comments there. And then what Claire and I do is that we often go back there and we'll collate those comments and then we'll return them. We will write a collective letter of the comments of the outside witnessing and return it back to community, although they're all pretty savvy in Kalumburu on getting on the internet, and so I'm
looking
sure they're all checking
at
as
the comments.
Well. And there are actually, because these stories have been stored on Vimeo, but they've been shared on other platforms like ABC Kimberley or the actual Kalumburu website. Sometimes the comments come in other places, so we don't always get the comments on Vimeo as where people deposit them. But we would love people to go and listen to the stories and really think about, I suppose, what is it around those stories that, what do you think it says about that person, what they think, what they value, what their hopes are, but also importantly, what is it that you might take for your own life and how that might actually support you in your sort of strength to have your story and the way that your story progresses.
And I know that you've shared before we started recording today the possibility of doing a collective document. And it's got me thinking, because someone who works out in communities, there are lots of workers out there working with other strong women's groups around the country. And what's the potential for swapping documents between other women's groups where they might record stories in a similar way and perhaps send them to Kalumburu for comment from the Kalumburu women? I don't know. That's what excites me about this project. And
Lucy, that's exactly what one of the women said to us at the last project that we did. They wanted to know whether other women were doing this. And this was after the viewing of all the stories, about sharing those stories with other people and hearing and learning from those from other places. So we would love it to hear from other community groups. In fact, I have to say that we would love to be invited as Telling Story Project to come to other communities and work alongside community members to actually create archives of strength, hope and resilience for other communities. Mm. And, you know, we've really seen the benefit of that. And I think the most delightful part for me is, you know, often Claire and I will catch ourselves looking at each other and thinking, God, I love this work. You know, I love working in this way in so many ways. It's so different to work that we may have been involved in many years ago. And also that sense of going, feeling very proud of the work and feeling very excited that people, particularly, you know, the Tramulla Strong Women's Group and the Kalumburu community, continue to invite us back. And that's a pretty good outcome in the sense of going, we're doing something right. As a cooperative, working collaboratively, there's some strength in that, and community has seen the benefit of that. So that's a really lovely endorsement for us, and we would love to be able to create those relationships in other communities so that other communities can equally start to work in that way and start to unearth their stories.
So if there is any social workers, other OTs, other professionals, allied health sector that, yeah, may be interested in getting involved in the project and doing it in their own community and perhaps inviting you into that community, what I'll do is get you to talk at the end about how they might get in contact with you, what's the best way of getting in contact with you and Claire. Before we get to that point, though, I really want to touch on perhaps what might have been some of the challenges or struggles that you've faced in your work, either through the project or in other parts of your work. What has been the biggest challenge for you?
I think the challenge for me has been around, or one of the biggest challenges, I shouldn't say it's the biggest challenge, but the balancing act between sort of the funding requirement or the organisational structure requirement and what feels like the therapeutic benefit or the therapeutic approach. And yeah, I completely understand how they linked, but I find that the challenge often. You know, we're often challenged by the concept, and not only with the Telling Story Project. In the Telling Story Project, we're challenged sometimes with how do you evaluate the Telling Story Project? How do you evaluate any project that has a long term kind of slow burn of change? You know, it's not a dramatic space. Although there are very dramatic moments within it, but you know, you might see an ember flare, but you don't know if that's going to continue on. And yet, how do we balance that with what often funders are requiring, which is a very structured kind of approach around, you know, ticking boxes around things? And it's really interesting for me. That seems probably, actually, that probably is the biggest challenge. I worked on developing a perinatal mental health screening tool called the Kimberley Mums Mood Scale, which was very much around looking at how do we pick up when women might be experiencing perinatal mental health concerns. And I was the mental health clinician on that team. And we struggled with certain sectors wanting us to have a very tick-off box to myself, who was wanting to have a structured interview conversation that would make a difference. Yeah, I think that there's that tension that can happen between those two places. Around how do you get funding, how do you evaluate things, how do you kind of help make sense of what you're doing for people who may not come from that framework or have a different requirement in what they're looking for. You know, hats off to the people who have funded us, because they have taken a leap to do that, and that's really exciting that there are those spaces that are opening up where people are looking at ways of doing things differently, but at the same time we also know that funding is kind of getting less, and so it's also how do we work creatively in this space? How do we work using other models and other places to get funding in that area of social emotional wellbeing, which is much greater.
So you mentioned the word evaluation in there, and I'm wondering, with the expectations that funding bodies might have around getting certain outcomes and hearing that this story has made a difference to people's lives, tell me about how you're evaluating it.
Yeah. Oh, thanks, Lucy.
How are you meeting that challenge of giving the funding bodies some idea of what impact this project has made, while also honouring the therapeutic work and the benefits of that for people?
Well, it is an ongoing challenge. And I suppose that really we honour the concept of working in the narrative framework. And so it is by the narrative report that we return. So every funding opportunity that we've had has required us to give tick box numbers of, you know, how many participants, what was their ages, sex, were they Indigenous, not? All of those questions, and we do that. And we could leave it at that because they don't ask us for a narrative report, not always. But no, that's not what we do.
Exactly.
We write a narrative report that has story. It has the story of the process, and it has people's words in it, and it has reflections as clinicians in that space as well about what is it that we've seen. And we know that when we've worked in clinical settings where we're doing process group work, this is what it is. It's a process group work, and we do our clinical observations in a way, and those clinical observations are framed in a way of through a narrative lens. People's words come back from what people are saying, and in a sense that there is the evaluation about what people find helpful or valuable about the process. And for those who have either been part of just the process group, so we did a Tree of Life process project over a period of time, and we collected story along the way about what it was that people found helpful.
Yeah.
And we ask, is this helpful still? Is this the way we're asking these questions? Is this okay? Or do you want us to do something differently? Would you like us to ask something else? You know, so yeah, so we co-create that way, and they've continued to fund us, so that was kind of good. So I think we've ticked it off to some degree.
And as you were speaking, the words that you spoke earlier about that woman's reflection about, I didn't know that I could inspire others, or something along those lines, quotes like that are so valuable in showing what a difference this makes to people.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I didn't think I could be so inspirational. And I think that's a pretty lovely base for people to think about.
Yeah, gorgeous. So finishing off, is there another sparkling moment or story that you would like to share in maybe the difference that working in a narrative way has made to your life and your work? Yeah, is there a story there that you can share about what difference working narratively has made to you?
I will share a story actually around Ashlyn, who's the 17-year-old young girl who was actually the first person who was part of our story collection in the Telling Story Project, who was the young woman who said, I didn't know I could be so inspirational. Mm. And we had a really beautiful time sitting with Ashlyn, a really lovely conversation. And you know, I hope people will have an opportunity to watch her video. But she talked very much about schooling away. She also talked about the things that kept her strong when people had passed, and what she used, and how she managed death and loss and grief. And after this project, so we spent the first project in Clumberoo, and after that project, we returned to our homes, and unfortunately my father became very unwell, and I went down to Perth, and he had a very short but acute illness. And it was really interesting for me. Unfortunately, it was my first parent who passed away. And Ashlyn sat on my shoulder very much about the words that she said and the way that she had spoken about how she managed that grief. And also she talked about casting your line as far as you can, which is the theme that her grandmother, who had passed, had taught her. Mm. And when I turned back to Broome, that was very much why I moved to the Territory. I moved because I used her strength, really, about not only getting through that time, but also about casting my line as far as I could and knowing that I was still tethered, which is how she spoke about not being in Clumberoo but being in Perth schooling, but knowing that she was still connected to Clumberoo. And for me, that was very much where I spent 18 years in Broome, and that was very much my home. And so that sense of casting myself as far as I could, which was to Darwin, and still staying tethered. And I had a really lovely opportunity the second time I went to Clumberoo to see Ashlyn and have a chance to give my thanks to her about what an incredible level of strength she had given me through one of the most difficult times that I've ever experienced, actually, and how lovely it was that a 17-year-old could teach a 51-year-old how to stay strong and cast your line as far as you can, which is, yeah, really beautiful. So that's, in a sense, a gem around really being able to listen to stories with intent and being sometimes surprised about which story will hold resonance and when those stories will be really important to remember. And so, yeah, it was a very beautiful moment. And I love that about narrative practice. I love the fact that we are co-creating things together and that the journey is as transforming for the one who's the storyteller as it is for the one who's the listener.
Did you go into this work expecting to have such a profound experience with the impact on your own life?
Well, I think what's really interesting is that often in our training, what we're taught about is what potential negative impact of our work will be of hearing these stories. You know, we're often talked about, you know, vicarious trauma or, you know, like about burnout or, you know, we don't actually, like, right at that point where we're actually being trained, we're not trained to listen to how transporting those stories can be for ourselves and our own life. And so in a way, I think that part of the curiosity and the desire to set up the Telling Story Project was because stories had been transformative prior. I think I didn't realise, like, I knew that there was a slow burn of that shift and that change. I think for me, the Clumberoo Telling Story Project, I thought it was going to be transformative because I've never been to that part of the country, and I knew it was an incredibly beautiful part of the world and also a very strong and rich cultural heritage that people had in that space. But I suppose I wasn't expecting it to be as profound. And I think that's because I've never really been given the space to really listen and to really listen to people's story in a way that is really open to listen to stories for that strength, hope and resilience. And I think that's the most transformative space.
Gorgeous. Well, I'm aware that our time's pretty much up. So, yeah, I just want to thank you, Suda, for sharing the whole story and experience of your time in Northern Australia and what that's meant to you, and particularly around the Storytelling Project or the Telling Stories Project. I'm really excited about what you've been doing, and it certainly reflects some of the things that I've been trying to do in Tiwi. And yeah, I hope that there's an opportunity where we might collaborate in the future around some of this stuff. And I hope that there's people listening too that might engage in this process as well. So just on finishing up, if you could let us know, what's the best way for people to track you down if they would like to talk to you?
Okay, I'll give you my email address so that you can pop that at the bottom. So okay. We have a telling story project at gmail.com, which is a email address that both Claire Woods and I access. And I'll also give you both Claire and my email address. So please, if people would like to contact us to have more of a conversation, that would be fantastic. And I'm really, because I am also really curious about how people listen to story within their own practice. And we all do it. Okay. And I suppose, how do we listen to it in a different way than maybe we're trained to listen to or we've got used to listening to? So
great. Yeah. Maybe we can, when I post this podcast on Facebook, maybe we can start a bit of a conversation about that. I'll put that out there as a bit of a question. What do you think?
Yep, lovely.
How are other people listening to story and using the power of story in their work?
Sounds great.
All right. Well, thank you again.
Thank you, Lucy. That's great.
Thanks for listening to Talk the Walk, the podcast putting legs on social work in Indigenous communities through story. Music by Flashback Digital. You can access all the show notes from today's podcast at www.metaphoricallyspeaking.com.au. I'm currently on the lookout for inspiring interviewees. If you or someone you know is walking the talk in their work or community, then I'd love to hear from you. You can drop me an email at lucy@metaphoricallyspeaking.com.au or visit my contact page on the Metaphorically Speaking website. Until next time, just keep on walking.